We're back on the record then in the case of Colton Snyder. Are you prepared to cross-examine?
Yes, I am, Special Master. Thank you. Good afternoon, Doctor.
Good afternoon.
My name is Tom Powers. I know that you've been in the room for at least some of the testimony that you've heard here, but I haven't had a chance to introduce myself. Obviously, I'm one of the attorneys representing the Snyder family in this case and representing the petitioners at large in the omnibus proceeding. I have a few questions for you, and I first want to go to your slide number 2, if you have that still available on your laptop.
It's not my laptop, but... Can you switch it back on? Or? It seems to have cut out.
And if it doesn't come on right away, it's not going to be particularly essential. I know that we have paper copies distributed, and it's just a couple of quick questions.
Sure. Just hit the log off issues.
Okay.
There we go. Okay, now we just need to go back to slide 2.
And this would be slide 2 if we...
Okay, that's great. So I didn't have it on the screen.
Okay, you know, we don't really have to have it up there if there's going to be a technical
problem. I have it in
front
of me, so if you want to go ahead, Mr. Powers, that's fine. Well, we're getting close. There we go. One more. Okay.
This one?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Just a couple of quick questions about this slide. The plotting that's done here, who did these plots?
This is Professor Simmons who did the plot.
And what data was Professor Simmons using to plot the graphs that we see here?
He would have been using the same data as I would have seen in the Series E.
And so the same data that you saw and the data that he's using here, where did that data come from?
It came from Unigenetics.
And are there any plots like this that you've introduced into evidence that Professor O'Leary or anybody else at Unigenetics did?
No.
Okay. Now, this plotting or the data that the plotting is based on, do you know whether this this data was from any general samples that would have been used to set up assays versus actual patients that were being examined?
These would have all been patients and controls. So in other words, claimants and controls.
Claimants and controls. So none of this would have been from assays and set up. And what's your basis for knowing that?
My basis for knowing that is that I've looked at the same data and I've seen the same results.
And this is the data that you've referred to that is not available?
Exactly.
Okay.
And you nodded? Was that a yes?
Yes, sorry. I mean, in total, I've seen data for about 300 claimants and children.
And so you've seen it, Professor Simons has seen it, but certainly none of the attorneys here have seen it, and the Special Master hasn't seen it.
No. But there is, you know, as far as my concerns are concerned, they are obviously, this is the sort of Alice in Wonderland experience that I have, where essentially I have in my report interpretations of data that I've seen, but I can't discuss with you.
Now, you made mention of contamination that you've identified contamination issues or claim to have in the Unigenetics work. I didn't hear you describe contamination in terms of negative controls. Negative controls came up negative when they should have come up negative. Isn't
not
that correct?
In all cases, because you know, as you remember from Stephen Buston's report, there are some indications that sometimes positives were ignored in these circumstances.
And that's based again on data that we don't have available.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Exactly, yes.
Okay. Yeah.
I speak up, okay.
You mentioned before moving off the slides, slide 4, if you could turn to that, please.
This one?
Yes, thanks. Now, slide 4, as I understand it, there, these these graphs and these plots, and I should be clear, one is a plot and one is a graph of a standard curve.
Yeah.
The plot and the curve are not based on any data that was contained in the O'Leary work, nothing to do with any data or any samples or controls from this litigation.
I only use this particular curve in my report as well to indicate the problem that there is, that a lot of extrapolation was being done below, and data and values were determined below the lowest point in the standard
curve. And this material is actually marketing material from a company that sells PCR equipment. I don't know if it's equipment or systems, as they call it.
It sells the kits to do it as well as the machine.
And so the lines that they generate here are essentially self-serving, and they're generating lines to say our curve is flatter,
the competitor in red is not so flat.
So this is a marketing material that is illustrative only and doesn't reflect anything about the data in these cases.
No, I only use it in order to illustrate a point that, and that point is made in my report as well, that a lot of the data that are provided by Unigenetics involve extrapolations outside the range of the standard curve.
Right. Now, I want to, just for a quick moment here, step away from the particulars of the testing methodology and PCR that you spent most of the morning talking about. Do you believe that the presence of measles virus RNA after an exposure represents continued measles virus replication?
That depends on what circumstances you do the testing. We've already heard that in certain instances, Diane Griffin's lab has been able to do PCRs and find it positive after 60 or 90 days, mm-hmm. depending on how you do, what particular set of patients you look at. If you do it under those circumstances, you don't actually know exactly what you have because the RNA itself is not that stable. In order for the virus to maintain its persistent state, it has to replicate. But you don't know whether you're looking at degraded bits of genome or whether it is still a whole replicating system.
Exactly. That's what I wanted to get to. So if you find measles virus RNA in a sample post-exposure, it's possible that it would represent, and I don't mean to use this in a particularly technical term, but an artifact of previous replication. It might not necessarily be replicating. Is that right? If it's embedded in a cell, it's just survived in a cell that has survived?
Well, to an extent, yes, but it depends entirely on the circumstance that you're looking at. In this particular case, she was looking at HIV-positive children, and she found that it was longer than we normally have seen.
Right, and just to make clear for the record, I think we're talking about the same thing. This is Dr. Griffin's 2001 paper on the HIV-positive versus HIV-negative children. And I think that was in Sadia, that was Petitioner's Exhibit, well, I don't think it was Petitioner's Exhibit 112, tab 1. So in that paper, she determined that through PCR, she identified RNA in the HIV-positive children and concluded that 60, maybe even more than that, days out, the virus was replicating in the system. The measles virus was replicating in the system of some of those HIV children.
Yeah, my interpretation is that that she has demonstrated that there's RNA there.
And the question is, does the demonstration of RNA there, does that suggest that replication has taken place?
It's a matter of some uncertainty as to how long RNA that is encapsulated in the nucleocapsid protein of measles virus can survive without replication. Okay, but It is very unlikely that is a very long period. And I must say that we have really relatively few data that suggest to us how long and not so long is. It's very clear that RNA by itself, as a naked RNA molecule, is quite unstable. It is very quickly hydrolyzed by the hydroxyl groups that are present in the cell's water, and that breaks it down very rapidly. So in order for the virus to stay as a entity, as a genetic entity that is capable of replicating itself, it is probably requiring constant replication over whatever, you know, for days, maybe even weeks. I can't say that. We have not really got any data to suggest, to give us an answer in that particular question. So if you ask me, is it necessary for a virus like a measles to persist over 8 years, as the average is the period between the manifestation of symptoms in SSP and in the case of, and the acute infection, then replication must occur. It's not like DNA, which is a very stable molecule.
Right.
But I don't know, if you ask me the specific question, I cannot tell you whether if you find RNA at day 90 in an HIV-positive child, whether that means that there was replication until weeks ago or days ago.
And if you had additional evidence in addition to the RNA and identified specific proteins, would that be helpful in determining whether replication had occurred? So if you found proteins that were further down the chain, you know, beyond N, and moving down that chain of proteins, if you found those would, along with the RNA, would that bolster the case for persistence in that instance?
It would be helpful, but I don't think that you could ever find that as conclusive evidence.
And even if not conclusive, if you did find that evidence, would that be through immunohistochemistry?
You could do that by immunohistochemistry, yeah.
And I heard you mention in your direct testimony earlier that the Ullman paper did not use immunohistochemistry.
Right.
I recall a passage in that paper that says that the results were confirmed by immunohistochemistry.
That's right.
So it sounds as if they did do immunohistochemistry to generate the results in the Ullman paper.
They were not in the Ullman paper. And if you read my report, then you'll see that that in my redacted report, I posed a large number of questions to the Union Genetics Lab, particularly because it was obviously there for the potential to be used later on in a hearing in the UK, and to establish what had not been done. And so the important element of that critique that I provided there was that if you confirm something, then please show it to me. I mean, your case would have been stronger if you had protein data, but you don't have them.
Except we
rely on a statement by Dr. Kennedy, and we rely on Dr. Bradstreet's paper, which obviously included Colton Snyder, for that particular confirmation. But I have never seen any data, and I have good reasons to doubt whether that was actually done properly, because some of the Unigenetics is not a lab that uses immunocytochemistry a lot. But a lot of the so-called confirmatory data that have been provided in this area come from Andy Wakefield. And his in the earlier stories that he had about the link between measles or measles vaccines or measles and mumps with infectious inflammatory bowel disease, he did try to do confirmatory immunocytochemistry. The first case he used...
And let me interrupt. I was just asking about a simple question about whether in the Ullman paper, they say that their results of PCR were confirmed by immunohistochemistry.
Yeah.
And my only question to you is whether that is a true... whether you believe, yes or no, that that's a true statement in the Ullman paper. Did they in fact confirm their PCR results with immunohistochemistry?
How could I know it? I've never seen any data. I've never seen any immunocytochemistry data in the, from Ullmann, from Unigenetics or from Andy Wakefield after the original set of the immunocytochemistry data that were based on his theory about inflammatory bowel disease, which now, was then demonstrated to be wrong in the sense that there's a paper by Iuzica which shows that there is cross-reactivity of the antibody that he had with human antigens. And secondly, in the first instance, and this is when I referred to my, my director already to my collaboration with Andy Wakefield, he used a serum which was a serum generated in a mouse by infecting the mouse with an adenovirus that expressed the measles nucleocapsid gene.
And that would be the N gene?
The N gene, yes.
Now, a question about the N gene. The N gene, is that the first gene that's produced in the replication cycle of the measles virus?
Yeah.
And it's that first in that series? And the N gene is the one that is the, I get you described it as being the highest
copy
count,
yeah,
the highest copy number.
Yeah.
And actually, I just want to make sure, when I say count and copy number, if we're using those terms, are we using the same terms? Does that work for you?
I would prefer to use the copy number.
Yeah. So for the N gene, then, that is the gene you would expect to have the highest copy number.
That's right.
And you described how in the work here, they weren't looking for the N gene. Is that correct?
That's right.
And that, in fact, they were looking for the F gene. That's what slide 2 talks about, is the search for the F gene.
Yeah.
Now, the F gene is much further down the chain of genes that are involved in replicating measles virus. Is that right?
In transcription of the virus, yeah.
In transcribing it. And then presumably the presence of F gene would indicate that the sequencing that preceded the F gene, involving N and everything else in between, if you found the F, that would indicate that everything preceding it was there. Is that correct?
If you had done a proper test, then obviously I don't believe that the tests were done properly.
Yeah, I'm just talking about the goal.
Yes, I mean, that would have been the normal expectation. Yeah.
Right, and then presumably one might do that to establish, or at least make a stronger case for replication, so that if you have the F gene, you might be able to make the argument, at least as a goal, that replication had been taking place in those locations where you found RNA. Does that make sense as a goal approach in a study like this? Looking for the F rather than N because you're looking to find replication. Does that make sense?
No, it doesn't. I tell you why. If you first of all wish to establish whether there is measles in a particular sample, you're not immediately concerned whether the question whether it is replicating, whether it is transcribing, active, how much is there, but you want to have to give yourself the best chance of finding that particular virus. Then you would go for the N gene, and the Unigenetics people tried to get results for N, F, and H, and essentially what they then found was that somehow they were not able to establish a good N gene assay. Clearly, they would have liked to have seen the confirmation that all these RNAs would have been there. So, if you try in the first instance to say, well, is it there or not, then you must go for the N gene, you must work very hard to get that. The secondary goals in terms of looking at whether there is replication or transcription or replication without transcription, that's impossible, but whether you have transcription without replication, that would all be reasonable to say, now I'm starting to look at the other genes. But to take that particular gene as the first target would not be a sensible approach to my mind. And so I know that they tried and they failed.
And your knowledge is based again on documents that we don't have available here?
Let me think. would have to check. I'm not sure whether the Ullman paper makes a reference to the fact that they tried the other genes, but because, as you know, the Ullman paper also dealt with the solution phase RT-PCR and the fact that that they had tried to use primers for the N, the F, and the H. And as you know, the Ullman paper itself has a list of N, F, and H primers in it.
Now, you talked towards the end of your testimony about a meeting that happened where a group of people discussed whether they wanted to proceed with taking new samples from children and running tests on those samples to see if the results could be replicated. Do you remember that discussion?
Yeah.
And you reported that the upshot of that group's decision was to not go forward with doing that, and you described the reasons for that. I just want to learn a little bit more about that meeting. That meeting was a group of people that were representing the defendants.
Sorry, I might have given the wrong impression about the meeting. At some stage, the legal teams ask us, is there any value in asking for samples of these children in order to establish whether the human genetics data are correct or not?
So I'm really careful here. The legal team that you're describing, you use the word plural, but these weren't legal teams from both sides of the case. This was the legal team that was representing the pharmaceutical companies.
Right.
So the direction to have this meeting was not by joint agreement of the parties, but the defendant pharmaceutical companies directed you all to have a meeting. Is that fair so far?
What they asked us was the following question.
I just want to establish who the they is. Am I correct in saying that the they who directed you to have this meeting,
the people who would be representing the respondents in court, the barristers, asked us.
Yeah. That's all I was trying to establish. So those are the people that call the meeting.
No, they didn't
who
call the meeting.
They
asked the question, and I said, I'm sorry if I've misled you about there having been a meeting. What was the situation was that a number of us were asked by correspondents, do you think it's worth testing the children? And then all of us came to the same conclusion that this was not the way forward.
And when you say all of us, these would be all
Let me finish my question, please.
These would all be paid and retained experts exclusively on the side of the pharmaceutical respondents?
They would.
And did you all in those discussions, where it sounds like there was some consideration given to the children, did anybody from your side ever contact the families or the people who were responsible for the children to get their opinion on whether testing would have been appropriate and whether they would have been willing to undergo that?
I think I'm straying too far into matters that I cannot discuss.
I'm sorry, I've just missed.
I'm sorry, I'm straying too far into matters that I cannot discuss.
And you cannot discuss these matters because of a seal or confidentiality order imposed
by
the British courts?
There's a confidentiality order on a number of the discussions that obviously we had.
I have no further questions. And Special Master, I'll say this on the record, we had discussed it and it's come up a couple of times. We will be asking for leave to file a supplemental report here in response to some of the information that's been presented, presuming that we can get a hold of some of this underlying documentation from the United Kingdom litigation. And
let me deal with the second part of that first. Are you going to request unsealing of the British litigation, of additional portions of the British litigation?
Yes, we are, Special Master.
And when are you going to do that?
We have that process has begun. We have inquiries to the court in the UK, and we are initiating that proceeding.
Okay. Again, I'm going to ask when, because you were invited, in fact, encouraged. In fact, all three special masters dealing with this litigation said we would join with you back 5 months ago to get the complete data. We've had 5 months, and it appears that the petitioners have sat on their hands. So when?
I just honestly don't know what the timeline is. I know that in the UK system, I mean, it's taken weeks literally just to get a copy of the order.
And copy of which order?
The confidentiality order. They don't just send it over. And I honestly don't know and cannot represent to you today how long that process would take, but we are...
Well, I'm discouraged from the testimony of Dr. Kennedy, who told me that he had not been asked to request disclosure of his report prior to his testimony here in this case. And from the whole discussion of this prior to the start of the Cedillo trial, as Mr. Matanowski described the process the government went through to get records unsealed, that they approached their expert witnesses and asked them to join in the request to unseal that testimony, and that the petitioners have not taken that step. This is concerning to me because we would like to get a speedy resolution of not only Colton's case and Michelle Cedillo's case and Yates Hazelhurst's case, but all of these cases.
Understood.
So I'm putting you on notice that you got to move on this. We're not going to tolerate sitting on our hands.
Understood.
Okay. You have no other questions for this witness?
No other questions for this witness. No, Special Master.
Okay. I have a few, Dr. Rima. And let me ask this question this way. You heard Dr. Kennedy's testimony about Dr. O'Leary's current activities. That is, he's recently published several articles involving RT-PCR. I think Dr. Logan is the lead author on those articles. And you've heard that he was recently awarded the St. Luke's Medal by the Royal Academy of Medicine and St. Luke's Hospital, and that he is the chair of pathology at Trinity College Dublin. Publications, awards, university chairs don't seem to square to me with the picture you've painted of what happened in the Unigenetics O'Leary lab. Can you shed any light for this on me?
I cannot. I am not on the award panels that have made these awards. I am not on the. I have not been asked to be an external examiner or person on the Trinity College appointment panel. So I am not. Of course, that particular appointment took place well before this particular, before Unigenetics started to work, because he was appointed quite a long time ago for his professorship at Trinity. So I have no observations to make. If I was on the St. Luke's award panel, then I could tell you on what basis they have made that decision.
Well, let me phrase the question this way: that we've heard that contamination is not unusual in labs doing PCR. Is that correct?
It is correct, and I certainly have experienced it myself, as I identified in my report.
Can you square the problems in the O'Leary lab that you've discussed and Dr. Simmons and Dr. Buston have discussed in testimony and in reports with mere contamination or mere carelessness?
What I have provided evidence of is carelessness in certain instances. I've provided you this morning with evidence where I found some of the practices unacceptable as a scientist. That's all I can say.
I think that answers my question, Dr. Rima. At the time Colton's samples or Michelle Cedillo's samples were sent to the O'Leary lab, were there other labs doing PCR of cerebral spinal fluid, whole blood, for a measles virus, or was this the only lab doing it at the time?
It was the only lab, and let me explain this. I mean, if the technology had been validated, then Dr. O'Leary would have found me and Oldstone and several other people interested in measles virus work at his door saying, can you help us resolving issues about not only this disease, I can give you other diseases that where there is a question about the involvement of measles virus in Paget's disease of bone, in otosclerosis, and I'm involved in several of these sort of instances where people are struggling to try to find a link or an etiology for a disease which has no known etiology. And so if indeed that technology had been validated, and if that indeed had been the circumstance, a lot of people would have knocked on O'Leary's lab and said, you can do something which we can't do. And there would have been a flood of people coming to him, independent of the litigation or so. But that flood hasn't taken place, for the very simple reason that everyone who has looked at it has said, no, well, actually, this technology does not work. What he claims he can do, he cannot do, and what he claims he simply has not been able to give us the sort of confidence in his technology that would allow us to start looking at it from a research perspective. And that's a research perspective. It's not, and that is a very different perspective even from the perspective of a diagnostic lab that is going to test children for pathological conditions that there are. So I would have said, I would have been the first on this floor. I mean, he is only 100 miles down the line from me in Ireland, and I would mean some great. I like to work with this person. But it was clear that the company that was set up by Unigenetics has only one training activity, and that was to test measles presence in samples from the litigants in the UK. And so essentially when people started to look at it and when measles experts came into the field, and because we tried to get as many people involved, and both on both sides attempts were made to involve people, We came quickly to the conclusion that some of the practices that I've described here, some of the sloppiness, some of the inconsistencies in the data were there, and they led us to the conclusion that this simply does not work.
You've characterized the reports of measles virus in Colton as headline reports, and in the ordinary course of my work, I rely on headline reports. I mean, I don't ask the lab at whatever institution has tested blood for the presence of whatever we might be looking for, a virus, a bacteria, whatever might be at issue in our case. I look at headline reports routinely. As I understand what you just told me, it is the nature of the purpose for which this lab was established, that, and as well as the practices of the lab, that leads you to question the reliability of the results in Colton's case.
Yeah.
And that you would not or routinely question a headline report.
Well, I'm obviously not in your position, and so I don't know what I would question. I mean, I'm a scientist. I question anything that comes on my desk, and in the first instance, do not believe it until I'm convinced that I can. And in that sense, it was a clear experience that we had. Once we started to look at that, it was clear that we couldn't have much. We couldn't rely on what was made available to us. But why I call it a headline is because it is based on the that is based on two figures, a numerator and a denominator, which could be both small and multiply up And one small figure divided by an even smaller figure gives you quite a large figure. Leads to this completely and utterly biologically implausible situation where, as I said, if you come forward with a situation where you have 2 times 10 to the 7 copies per nanogram, that means that that whole cell is stuffed with measles F messenger RNA, let alone the fact that Mr. Powers has already indicated that that should have also had N, N, P, N, M, and H, N, L as well. And so essentially what we are seeing is something that is biologically, I would almost say, impossible. A cell normally has about 200,000 copies of message. So if you say to me that this sample contains 2 times 10 to the 7 per nanogram, that is 2 times 10 to the 5, 200,000 copies of measles F, then there's no more space or availability for the housekeeping genes that need to be there, for the other genes of measles that need to be there. So it is simply impossible to have these figures. And that is where, when figures like that came out in the Ullman paper, it was just like, this is nonsense.
So when you say these figures, you're referring to the figures in some of the papers and in some of the data you examined.
I give you the example of the Ullman paper and the Bradstreet paper where figures like that became available to us.
But in Colton's specific case, are the figures beyond plausibility?
Well, he has 34,000 copies per nanogram of RNA in the CSF. If I calculate that on a cellular basis, and I've already indicated why I do that, because I have no indications that free virus is there. If we do that, then he has about 3,400 copies of measles F per cell.
Of the 200,000 that...
Of the 200,000.
Available in a cell.
And in order to put that in context, I refer you to the fact that there's a paper by Cattaneo, which is in my report, which actually has measured copy numbers by other technologies than TACMAN. And... that they come to a conclusion that there are in circumstances where I take my best virus, the lab-adapted Edmondson strains, which grow much better than the wild types, in vero cells, which is a cell type which has no innate immunity and therefore is capable of really allowing the amplification of the virus to occur. In those conditions, I can get up to about 4,000 copies of measles F.
So we have a factor of 7.
No, we have 3,400 in Coulton Schneider. I have 4,000 in my best case of growing. So I would say, if that's the case, we have no difficulties to take those cells, grow up the virus, look at immunocytochemistry, because this would be analogous to my best capable to what I could grow best in the cell.
Okay. So this is just too high?
Too high.
Too high to be believed?
Indeed.
Okay. Questions?
Dr. Rima, to your knowledge, have any of Professor O'Leary's recent publications or awards dealt with his measles PCR research?
No, they haven't. They have done some publications on DNA viruses, which I've already indicated PCR is extremely sensitive, and there's no question that you can pick up one copy. And the latest paper has dealt with the diagnosis of a number of viruses in stools of patients. And these viruses are present in immense copy numbers in the stools. These are noroviruses and astroviruses, where essentially you have 10 to the 11, 10 to the 12 copies of free virus in the stools. And therefore it is not surprising that you can use this technology to make that diagnosis.
And by free virus you mean not present in a cell, but
not replicated, simply free virus.
Okay.
If you look at the stool samples of patients with that type of diarrhea, you end up with, you only see virus practically. It's a It's very infectious, as all of us know who go on cruises and end up on the wrong ship.
Just ensuring I understood the distinction between free virus and cellular
yep.
virus. Okay.
Now, there was some discussion on cross of the meeting that you mentioned on direct, and you sort of cut it off at one point because you didn't really want to talk, go into much more detail. But am I correct in remembering from your direct examination and talking about this inquiry into whether you were going to try and replicate the tests on the claimants themselves, that part of the reason, a big part of the reason, was because you didn't think it was medically or ethically justified.
Mm-hmm.
That's correct, and that was already your testimony here today.
Well, it is also, and I think, I don't know to what extent it was part of the record, but a number of CSF samples were sought after because the claimants then wished to start to find evidence for their conjecture that there was direct brain infection. And so similar to the U.S. cases of where CSFs were, samples were available, they were not in the original cases in the U.K. And essentially, people having looked at that found that that no laboratory in the UK was willing to take CSF samples from these children because they did not feel that that there was sufficient ethical background to validate or to justify taking those samples. And the children then, I had to travel to the US and I don't know where the sample was taken.
Now, Mr. Powers also asked you about the immunohistochemistry in Ullman. And then I wanted to make sure, is there anything else you wanted to add about why you're not confident in the immunohistochemistry done here?
Well, I mean, the Bradstreet paper is sort of referring to the fact that there might be immunohistochemistry done. But
let me be clear. It sounds sort of like immunohistochemistry and immunocytochemistry are interchangeable. Okay.
So, no, it hasn't been done, and it was, you know, it's surprising to me, and this is why I come back to the question of the headline figure being the only thing available. If you have data on the presence of measles protein in the CSF of these children, then I think it should have been presented to court.
Now, your report and your testimony today accurately summarize your concerns about unigenetics, correct?
Mm-hmm.
No,
and this
yes.
additional...
Yes, sorry.
Thank you, sorry.
I'm sorry, I'm learning slowly.
And this additional data that keeps getting referenced and, you know, that you can't talk about, this just provides more support for your opinions.
I think I have been able, on the basis of my redacted report, I hope, to convince the court that there were a number of questions about practices, consistency of the data, and the questions of contamination, etc., that would say to me, there is a question about the quality of the material that has been provided, in addition to the fact that there is not the sort of background information that we have seen available to us from the other claimants in the UK. That would have specified the cycle number for gap the age in that run, what the standards were doing in that run, what the standards for measles F were doing on that plate, where the sample was, how many positives were there on that particular plate on that particular day, and the actual copy numbers, which would have given rise to the headline figure. So this is where I think, first of all, I question the plausibility of these figures. Secondly, I then question, you know, the basis on which that figure has been arrived at, because I simply don't have the data. I, you know, part of being a scientist is trying to get confidence in the tests that are being presented to you, and all I have been able to say is that I, from my experience in that UK litigation, without having to disclose any confidential data, to say that I have no confidence in what I saw, and therefore I say that I, by extension, I simply cannot take on good face value the data that we have seen in the cases of Cedillo and Colton Schneider.
I have no further questions.
Just one quick one to follow up on there. In based on what Ms. Babcock was describing, and again without commenting specifically on content, is it your testimony that Dr. Cotter, without revealing any details of his report, is it your opinion that Dr. Cotter failed to replicate the work of the Unigenetics lab?
It is.
Okay.
And that is well documented in Professor Simmons' redacted report as well as in Professor Buston's report.
All right, it appears that we are ready for our lunch recess, and it's by my watch, it's, I forgot what time it is, it's a little after 12, so let's reconvene at about 5 after 1.